So as always, let's start with a short meditation. So finding a nice, comfortable posture. And as always, we begin by preparing the body, setting it in a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Preparing the mind, setting it in a state of ease and relaxation. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Simply noticing the rhythm of the in and out breath. Noticing if it's long or short, rough or smooth. Not trying to alter it in any way. and with your eyes at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. Simply release all appearances and simply rest within awareness itself. Without really trying to do anything at all. Without even trying to meditate. Just be. All sorts of appearances will continue to arise, but now pay no attention to any appearance. And simply rest in luminously clear awareness. Simply be aware of being aware. are relaxing completely, release awareness into space, releasing all appearances. Completely relaxed. And now sharpen the focus right into the present moment, right into the experience of awareness itself. Completely alert. And once again, relaxing completely, release the awareness into space, releasing all appearances. Completely relaxed. Once again, sharpen the focus right into the experience of awareness itself. Clear and alert. And then simply allow the mind to come to rest. Resting within luminously clear awareness. relaxed and alert. Open and spacious. So again, let's start with a short review. So we're looking at the path to enlightenment based on the three types of person. To make our life meaningful at three ever-expanding levels. And we saw that in the first level, a person of small capacity, we're simply striving for a good future. Basically through ethical lifestyle, ethical behavior, avoiding non-virtuous actions, engaging in virtuous actions, and purifying any negative behavior, any negative imprints that we have. And then at the medium level, we are not only striving for a good future, but we're striving to break free of samsara altogether, breaking free of this state of dukkha that we find ourselves in. And there, of course, the trainings are the three higher trainings. So on the basis of ethics again, so ethics is the foundation of every level. Then on top of that, we're developing concentration. And then on that basis, with a focused mind, coming to gain insight with the wisdom practice, and in particular here, the insight into no self. And through that, we can overcome our mental afflictions, suffering, and achieve liberation, personal liberation from samsara. Then, of course, we can build on that to understand that we're not the only ones stuck in samsara, everyone else is as well. And the person of great capacity then is striving for not just personal liberation from samsara, but the striving for the goal of enlightenment so that they can effectively help liberate everyone else from samsara as well. And so here we saw that, of course, the entry point into this Mahayana path to enlightenment is the aspiration of bodhicitta. We have to cultivate this aspiration first, and then we can strive for the goal of enlightenment, of course. And we saw the two methods there, the seven cause and effect and the exchanging self with others, the two main methods that were taught. So we can use these methods to develop this aspiration for enlightenment for the welfare of others, this aspiration of bodhicitta. And then we can formalize that commitment by doing a ceremony where we formally make the commitment, which is called aspirational bodhicitta. And then we can look at the various precepts and trainings that we would need to engage in and familiarize ourselves with these, and then we can also make a formal commitment to actually practice these through the also the bodhicitta ceremony, the engaging bodhicitta, where we take these what's called bodhisattva vows. And then, of course, these precepts are to help support us in our practice and support us in cultivating bodhicitta. And then, of course, the practices here, the main practices mentioned are these six perfections practices. And the first, of course, was generosity. And that three main types, of course, is to be generous in a material way, material gifts. And then, of course, we can be generous in helping to protect others from danger or fear. And then, of course, at the deeper level, we can be generous in terms of dharma, giving advice and guidance to others. And then the second of the three trainings, which builds, of course, on that, is the ethics. And here ethics was, again, three types. So the foundation is the restraint, avoiding non-virtuous harmful actions. But here ethics, of course, is more proactive as well. So included in ethics is also the ethics of virtuous behavior and benefiting others as well. And then the next practice was patience, which builds on that ethics, because if we're ethical, then it's easier to cultivate patience. And so patience here also had the three types, the patience of not reacting to harm, so simply having a calm, clear mind in the face of a difficult situation. Then there was the patience of accepting suffering, so that we don't magnify the amount of suffering we experience. And also then through that, being able to learn from these suffering experiences and benefit from them. And then also there was the patience of the conviction with the teachings, with the Dharma, meaning to have that patience or forbearance while we are practicing the Dharma and to gain conviction with respect to the various practices. And then on top of that, the next one, the fourth one, was the joyous effort or joyous perseverance. And so also this had three types. And there we had the armor-like perseverance, where we really make the motivation to engage with joy in practices. So we armor ourselves with this thought. And then we engage in the virtuous practices, and the that can also, again, in just being general, the virtuous behavior, or benefiting others. So those were the three types that were mentioned. And of course, what is blocking us from this joyous perseverance is laziness. So we had a look at the three types of laziness there, and how to overcome that. And then also to support our joyous perseverance in our practices, we had those four powers, that to really have that joyous perseverance, initially it comes from, of course, faith in the practice that we are engaging in. And that means to have faith. By reflecting on the benefits of the practice, we can develop faith that this practice is going to really bring us a lot of benefits. And then from that, we can aspire to actually do the practice. And so that's one of these powers, this power of aspiration to do the practice, which will support then us to joyfully do the practice. And then also we had this power of steadfastness, that it's very important to have this power of completing the things we begin, because if we keep giving up on difficult things, we're never going to progress very far in the spiritual path. And then, of course, then there was the power of joy, meaning having this in this sort of joy of even just wishing to do the activity rather than the joy of getting some sort of result. And also what was important here was this power of relinquishment, to know when to rest, to when we're really fatigued and tired, is to really to take rest. Otherwise, we'll overextend ourselves and burn ourselves out. So here, the analogy was that we should have an effort like the continuous flow of a river, not too intense and not too lazy. So we need that balanced middle way. And then, of course, the last two perfections were the concentration and wisdom, which is the main two topics now that we're going to look at today and tomorrow. And so then let's have a look at those two in more detail now then. So we're on page 33 of the outlines. And this Lam Rim Chenmo that we're following, of course, translated into English, comes into three volumes. And this, just these two practices of concentration and wisdom is one complete volume of the three. So seems like concentration wisdom is quite important. So let's have a look at those two practices. So, of course, here it talks about serenity and insight. So serenity here is a translation of the Sanskrit word shamatha, which is a particular level of concentration that we can develop in the spiritual path. It's the minimum concentration we need to be able to have a stable and clear enough mind to come to realize nature of reality directly. And then insight, of course, is a translation of the Sanskrit word vipassana, or Pali word vipassana. And so we're going to first look now at the shamatha practice, the concentration practice. So we are sort of towards the bottom of page 33, how to train in meditative serenity, or how to train in shamatha. And first outline here is the relying on preconditions for meditative serenity. So here it talks about six things, six preconditions that are going to be very supportive or helpful for us as a basis to begin this practice. So let's have a look at what they are. So the first of the six here is dwelling in an appropriate area. So this is really talking about a supportive environment. And within that, there are five things listed here that what makes up a supportive environment. And remember this, of course, this is talking about these preconditions is for someone who really wants to engage in this shamatha practice in a very extensive way. So it's really talking a lot here about a sort of a retreat setting. If someone wanted to really engage in shamatha practice extensively, what sort of setting? So here the first point is easy access. And so this is talking about easy access to like food and drink and so forth. Then being a good place to live. This is talking about a safe place. And often in these old texts that talked about what it meant to be a good or safe place, they said a place that doesn't have any lions and tigers and so forth. But also they talk about robbers and thieves and, you know, things like that as well. So maybe in some of the places in the Middle East now, like in Syria, maybe not a good place for this practice. The third one here, it says being on a good piece of ground. Again, it's just really talking about a healthy environment, one that's not has a lot of disease and so forth. The fourth one, offering good companionship. So also this, of course, then brings up the idea of sangha, the idea of being that you have people around, supportive people, like-minded people that can help support you in the practice. Number five is being well situated. And here it explains what that means. It means there's not too many people in the day and little noise at night. So again, that there's not too much noise around and it's this nice and quiet place. So these are some of the elements of a supportive environment. And then the others here are more sort of internal things within the person. The next two are related together, having little desire and being content. So, of course, here we're talking about material things. So, of course, if we have a lot of desire to make more money, accumulate more stuff, then this is not going to be very conducive to developing shamatha. So, therefore, we should have little desire and be content in terms of what we have. So the difference here, of course, is little desire means in terms of things we don't have, and being content is with respect to things that we do have. And then the fourth one is completely giving up many activities. So this is really talking about simplifying our lifestyle so that we can engage in the meditative practice. Because here often we hear people say, yes, I'd like to meditate, but I don't have any time. I'm too busy. So again, I think that's never really a valid excuse. Of course, there are certain activities that most of us have to do. Most of us probably have to work somewhat to earn enough money, and most of us then have to probably go do some shopping and various other activities. But beyond those essential activities, then often we fill up our day with lots of other stuff. And a lot of that is not really that meaningful or beneficial. Again, often we tend to just do that because, you know, it's often thought that in our modern society, if you're not doing something, you're not being productive. So we have to do something. And then, of course, if we're not doing something, then that sort of really forces us to look at the state of our mind, which is often a mess. So then we don't like what we see, so we often then just distract ourselves so we don't have to look at our own mind. So rather than forcibly cutting things out of our life, if we use that approach to simplify our life, I think it's always going to be a struggle because you're always going to want to be doing those things. What we need to do is to change our attitude. We need to reflect on our precious human life and death. And if we do these two reflections, then we're going to see how a lot of these extra activities are just, we're just wasting our life with them, and we're going to lose interest in them. So then we can easily let go of a lot of these extra activities. So this is how we can effectively simplify our life. And then, of course, number five, pure ethical discipline. Basis, I think, of any spiritual path, any meaningful life, is ethical lifestyle. And then, of course, the sixth one says completely getting rid of thoughts of desire, etc. This is really talking a lot about sort of obsessive compulsive thinking, that most of us tend to obsess or compulsively think about certain things, and of course that's not going to be very conducive to developing a calm, clear, focused mind. So we really need to work on any sort of obsessive compulsive thinking that we may have and really let go of that. Because often this excessive obsessive compulsive thinking is on the basis of suffering and happiness is coming from out there. And we're trying to work out how to get those things, or worried about certain things and obsess and compulse about that. So again, I think what's going to be very helpful here to reduce that is to really understand that the source of happiness and suffering is coming from within. So these are the six preconditions that are normally mentioned as the conditions we need to support our shamatha practice. But I think if we look at those, we can understand that if we want to do any sort of practice, if we want to really have any sort of meaningful life, then I think these six points would be very helpful to try to gain these six preconditions. Any questions about the six preconditions?
Yeah.
Is there any point in trying to practice shamatha before one has accumulated or arranged all six preconditions?
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course, sometimes here we can, it's a bit chicken and egg in that, of course, if we do shamatha practice, then our thoughts of desire and so forth will diminish. But of course, if we have obsessive compulsive thinking all the time, then it's going to be hard to sort of enter into that practice. So I think that we try to cultivate these as much as we can, then enter into the practice, shamatha practice or whatever, and then continue to work on these things as well. And I think they will work together. Because if we think, okay, until I have all of these six things well, I'm not going to start, I think we're probably never going to start. But if we have the opposites of these things in a huge amount, then probably not going to be able to start at all. I mean, if we're so much caught up in craving more money, more stuff, I mean, we'll sit down and, I mean, you're not going to be able to begin to do anything.
Well, I find it more of a challenge in finding a quiet environment and giving up any activity.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is also, of course, in fact, if we look at the top in that section, it says, here there are six. In particular, the most important ones are good ethical discipline, seeing desires as disadvantageous, and dwelling in appropriate area. So exactly. And unfortunately, many of us don't really dwell in very appropriate areas. We tend to be environments where there's a lot of noise, a lot of people who are really influencing us in a negative way. There's all this media stuff, you know, TV, all of this internet stuff and, you know, Facebook and all that, that's really just not very conducive. Yeah. In the lift, there's music playing. Yeah. So I think then what we can do is try to find a more, you know, of course, if we have a job in the city, then, you know, we can't live 3 hours away, although sometimes people do and then commute for 4 or 5 hours a day, which also I think is not such a good idea. Because we never get an opportunity to use that quiet time because we're just never there and we're completely exhausted when we're there. But I think it's whatever we can do to try to find that is best. And also I think therefore, in terms of a retreat environment, then to come to a place like this or something where one, it's more quiet. Two, there are other people who are also trying to do the retreat and you get the group energy. So generally as a beginner, to do this practice in a retreat setting, it's very much recommended to do it in a group environment rather than individual, because as an individual, even if we have an appropriate place to do retreat, a lot of these other things interfere. We still have a lot of thoughts of desire. We have a lot of other things that are making it difficult for us to take use of that good environment. But if there's a group there and someone's leading the retreat, then it's much easier to follow and do that. So generally for a beginner, I think it's better to do that. Once we, of course, subdue the mind a little bit and we become a little bit more, have this joyous perseverance, then we can start to do some individual solitary retreats. But again, start short, a few days or a week. Don't think I'm going to do 3 months retreat on my own. I mean, for most beginners, that doesn't work very well. In fact, often what happens is in the retreat, it's so difficult, they get so frustrated and upset, they actually increase their mental afflictions. And so we don't want to do that.
Is merit required?
Yeah, of course. I mean,
and then could you? I don't think I understand merit.
Right. I mean, merit is just basically positive state of mind. I mean, we have the two opposing forces: the mental afflictions, the negative thoughts and habits, and then we have the positive ones. So merit's about increasing that, which will sort of subdue that. So we know from our own experience that if we're going into some activity and our mind is very joyful and uplifted, it's much easier to do something that's difficult. But if our mind does not have that sort of positive energy to it and we're faced with a difficult thing, we just go, oh, no, I can't do that, and we give up.
So are they like, Is it like generosity points?
Yeah, I mean merit. Yeah, I mean merit.
Is it kind of like...
I mean, you could say like brownie points or something, yeah. But I mean merit. Merit is just the result of virtuous activities. So we just engage in virtue, which can be generosity or any positive behavior is generating this, what's called merit. It's just like the positive imprints and the positive potential of the mind.
Okay.
That's all. I mean, it's nothing mystical.
Got it.
Yeah.
So just to put in like a, if I put the me back in merit, so if I, let's say that there was someone who did not have money and was asked for money, and so I gave them, I had $20 and I gave them $20. So I had a virtuous intention, and then I did a virtuous karmic action, right? So I planted a virtuous seed, which at some point will ripen into a virtuous result for me. Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that, now did I also generate generosity merit separate than that result?
Or no, that's all it's all the same thing.
Okay.
It's all the same package. It's not like merit something other than this. Merit is basically the result of virtue. So it is this positive imprint. It is the habit of being generous again, and it is then the result of seeing something, receiving something. It's all of that.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it's not some other mystical thing.
Right.
No.
Okay. So a separate pathway. Okay.
No.
Thanks.
So are there things that you can do that create more merit then?
Yeah. I mean, that was back in the karma section in terms of making things powerful. So therefore, the one of the main factors that it makes it powerful is motivation. And what's the highest motivation? Is bodhicitta. That's why here it talks about in each of these six perfections that we should try as best we can that when we're being generous, not simply, I mean, of course we can have any motivation for being generous. I mean, and it could be not a very good motivation, like, I'm being generous because then people will think that I'm someone good, you know. I'm giving this money to charity so that everyone else will think I'm a very nice person. Not a very good motivation, but of course that's better than not giving at all. But then of course we can give simply to benefit the charity, and then we can keep going up and up and up in our motivation. And what we're trying to do here is in any virtuous activity, have the motivation that may this be a cause for me achieving enlightenment so that I can liberate everyone else from suffering. This will create very powerful imprints. So one of the key factors is the motivation. Okay, then let's move on to the next part here. On how to cultivate, then it says on the top of page 34, how to cultivate serenity on that basis. So how are we going to cultivate shamatha? And of course, at the beginning, it talks about preparation, the six preparatory teachings. So that was what we mentioned right at the beginning, you know, that how do we prepare ourselves for a meditation session? You know, we need to have a nice clean place and we can give some offerings and so forth and have a nice posture, set a good motivation, purify the mind, and receive some inspiration. So these 6 points. So here it's talking about just preparing ourselves at the beginning of a session. And then the actual practice, the meditative posture here. Here it lists 8 points. So normally in terms of posture, they talk about the 7-point posture. But the 8th one here, the last one is, let your inhalation, exhalation flow effortlessly. So often then in the Lam Rim, they'll add that to the normal 7 points to make 8 points. To just let your breathing flow naturally. So I think you've gone through those points with Venerable Drolma, so we won't really go through it unless there is something in particular about the posture anyone would like to bring up.
I've read in a couple of places something about regulating the breath and coordinating the breath. Also in Iyengar, he talks about pausing at the end of the exhale to reduce mental activity. Is any of that?
Yeah. So, of course, there are various practices where we do breath manipulation, and they're for a particular purpose. You know, things like pranayama and so forth. And, of course, also on top of that, it's good to develop a good way of breathing. You know, often our breathing is not very... Yeah. So, I mean, there are exercises we can do to develop a better way of breathing so we get more oxygen in the body and so forth. So these are all things we can do as separate activities, and they can be very helpful, including, of course, then doing sort of yoga and so forth just to exercise the body in general. But here within the meditative practice, particularly here in the shamatha practice, that's not the right time to start manipulating the breath. Yeah, because the object of this practice is simply to be able to focus on an object. And if we are manipulating the breath at the same time, then of course we have two different objects of focus, and also that may interfere with our practice a little bit. So this is not the right time to do that, but in other occasions, various breath manipulation practices can be very helpful for various reasons.
I've heard that the yoga asanas are to prepare the body for meditation, for sitting and meditating.
Yes.
That's obviously, well, that makes sense to me instinctively, because good to move the body before you sit for a long time. That's obviously not what we're doing. So what are your sort of observations about that?
Yeah. So, yes, you're right. I mean, yoga is a whole system that has many levels, and asanas is one of the very first levels. But, of course, in our Western culture, that's sort of taken out of the whole yoga system, and that's presented as yoga, which is okay. I mean, it's good to do some physical asanas to make the body a little bit more useful, but we've sort of stripped it out of a whole system, you know.
Right.
Like mindfulness now, you know, mindfulness is often stripped out and made as a little separate thing, which, okay, can be a bit helpful, but we're limiting the usefulness of asanas and mindfulness by presenting them as a single isolated thing. So, yes, you're right. I mean, in the bigger picture, then asanas is an important part of preparing the body to be able to work with the mind. So therefore, we should also here make sure that we are having a healthy body. You know, mentioned a little bit about diet and so forth earlier, and getting the right amount of sleep and stuff. But also, I think some sort of physical body work will be very helpful for our practice. Like something like yoga or Tai Chi, Qigong or something. Even swimming or, you know, gym work is going to be helpful. In fact, I read a study some years ago where they had two groups of meditators. I think they were the Vipassana-style meditators. And they had, both of them had teachers. And what they did for 6 months was they did the same practice, and the groups were more or less the same level at the beginning. And they did the same practice for 6 months. And during that 6 months, one group was doing gym work and the other one wasn't doing any physical gym work. And at the end of the 6 months, the teachers, who didn't know which group was doing the gym work, had to look and see which group had progressed the most. And the group who'd done the gym work had progressed the most in their meditation practice. So, you know, I think it's very helpful to do some sort of physical body work, whatever form we feel works, you know, swimming or yoga or something. I think that, and of course, good diet, getting enough sleep and all of that is very helpful.
This active breathing thing, I remember reading something eons ago, probably 15, 20 years ago, in some sort of Buddhist text I was reading, that breathing really shallow, some are really shallow breathers, was breathing like a tortoise, and it was supposed to be a good thing.
See, what you will find is in the shamatha practice, as the mind calms down, then you'll find the breathing often gets very, very subtle. I mean, even to the point where sometimes you think, I'm not breathing. So, but again, the goal in this practice is not to try and make that happen. And that's what people sometimes do. And then all of a sudden they have to go to the big deep breath because they're out of breath, because they're artificially trying to restrict their breathing. And of course the body knows what, how much air you need. So just let the body do its thing. Don't try to make your breathing subtle, rhythmic, deep, long, whatever. Don't try to do anything because you're artificially changing it. And the body, I mean, the body knows how much you need, and it, just let it take care of itself, basically, in this practice. Okay. So let's now have a look at the meditative process. Says how to develop flawless concentration. The first outline is what to do prior to focusing the attention on an object of meditation. And here's some important information that can be very helpful to us. If you cannot stop the laziness of being disinclined to cultivate concentration and of enjoying things that are not conducive to it, from the outset you will not gain entry into concentration. Therefore, it is most crucial to stop laziness in the beginning. So this is often a point with practice is, and this goes back to one of the preconditions. If we still have a lot of desire for stuff, a lot of desire for pleasurable experiences, and we get caught up in all of these desires, we're not going to be able to even begin this practice because we're just going to get caught up all the time. And often then when people do this practice, and often people begin by focusing on the breath, then after a very short time, their mind of attachment goes, oh, this is so boring. You know, this is just so boring. And then, of course, we're off somewhere. And then, of course, we come back a bit, but then the mind just goes, oh, this is just boring, 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 boring. So, again, we need to overcome this laziness. And as we saw in the Shamatha chart, when we talked about the first fault of laziness, the antidote here, these four antidotes, faith, aspiration, effort, pliancy. So again, first we need to understand the practice and the benefits of the practice. So this is what it says here. You need a continuous, intense yearning that is intent on concentration. As a cause for this yearning, you need steadfast confidence in and fascination with the good qualities of concentration. So if we can really appreciate the benefit of this practice, what we are going to get out of this practice, then we'll have the first antidote, the faith in the practice. Then we'll have this intense yearning, this aspiration to do the practice. And then we're joyfully going to put effort into the practice, even if it is difficult. If we don't do this, we are going to be lazy when it comes to the practice, and we're not going to get very far. So this is the first fault that we need to overcome. Yeah.
Does fascination with the benefits of concentration include more than just knowing that we need to develop shamatha and able to practice vipassana?
Yes,
knowing about clairvoyance, clairaudience?
Not so much that, because that's, I think more is that the benefits of, you know, we're developing a calm, clear, focused mind, a stable mind. We're going to be the masters of our mind. The mental afflictions will be much less, much reduced, less intensity. We'll be much more effective in everything we do in our life, much less stress. All of these benefits. Health benefits. I mean, a lot of our physical illness is because of our agitated mind and mental afflictions, and simply developing this often has a lot of health benefits as well. I mean, all of these things we can look at. So yes, the benefit, of course, that this is a basis for Vipassana, will be able to penetrate reality and overcome mental afflictions, but also the immediate benefits. You know, our mind will be more peaceful, more calm, more focused, less stressed, less fatigue in doing things, all of these benefits. So if we can really appreciate all of these, and I think for many of us in our modern mind, we'll become the masters of our mind. We'll no longer be the slaves of our mind, tormented by our mind. I mean, that's something I think we all would like to have. So these are the sorts of benefits we can get from this practice, the immediate, more short-term benefits. And therefore, reflecting on that, I think we're not going to be lazy, because we're going to want to do the practice, because we're going to know, we're going to see that we're going to have a lot of benefit in our life. Like, and more of this comes right at the end of this section, the sort of the benefits if we, when we really get to the shamatha, but I'll mention that it comes later in the text at the end of the section. So there's more to be enjoyed. Okay. Then it says here what to do while focusing on the object of meditation. And how here for a whole page or more, it talks about different types of objects of meditation. And these different objects of meditation are, of course, are in general, the sorts of things we can meditate on. But then if we go down sort of towards the bottom of page 35, there's an outline there, B. It says, identifying objects of meditation for this context. So for this context, of course, is the context of shamatha practice. So which one of all of this list of things that were mentioned before is the object we should use for shamatha practice? And it says here, there is no single definitive individuals require their require their particular object of meditation. So here, what it's saying is that the general recommendation is use the object that works best for you. And then it goes on to talk about one example here. It says, to keep your attention on the physical form of the Buddha gives rise to limitless merit. It has advantages such as not losing your mindfulness of the Buddha as you die, and when you cultivate the mantra path, of course mantra path is Tantra Vajrayana, it heightens deity yoga, etc. So often in the Tibetan tradition, it's often, or particularly in the Geluk school, it's often recommended to use the mental image of a Buddha as the object for shamatha practice, because this is a virtuous object, but also then if we use this, we're becoming familiar with visualizing of enlightened form. So this is going to be very helpful later in the higher level of Tantra Vajrayana, where we do a lot of visualization in this way. But the reality is, I think for many of us, this is extremely difficult, because the mental image of a Buddha is quite complex and we're not so familiar with it. And many of us have difficulties with visualization in general. And then there's one other point here that's important. It says, if you cultivate concentration by moving to many dissimilar objects of meditation, it will be a great impediment to achieving serenity. Which means that in our shamatha practice, we shouldn't keep swapping the object. You know, one day this, next day that, another day another object. If we keep moving to different objects, we're never going to get very far. So what object should we use? Well, if we go back up two paragraphs, there it says, who should meditate on which objects? It says, if you have a predominance of discursiveness, then you definitely have to meditate on the breath. So discursiveness here, of course, means a conceptual mind, always thinking. I think this accounts for about 95% of the modern day population. We're all living in the head. OCD. OCD all the time, 24/7. So for most of us, then the recommendation, of course, here is that it's best to use the breath. Because again, the breath is physical. So by focusing on it, it gets us out of our conceptual OCD mind and into the body. And most of our discursive thinking, of course, is about the past and the future. Very rarely are we in the present moment. And if we live in the past or the future, then that's going to create a lot of unhappiness. You know, dwelling in the past, fear and worry or hope about the future creates a lot of suffering. So the sensations of breath only happen in the present moment. So by focusing on them, it gets us out of our conceptual mind into the body and out of the past and the future into the present. And so therefore, many of the Buddhist traditions emphasize using the breath. And as we saw right at the beginning, that this breath practice, we can have at least three variations. Focusing simply on sensations of the breath anywhere in the body related to the breath. This is good for emphasizing relaxation. Focusing on the area of the abdomen, which is emphasized in a number of the Theravada traditions. It's a fairly large area of focus. This is good for stabilizing the mind. And then focusing at the entrance of the nostrils, because it's a much smaller area of focus, is very helpful for improving clarity of attention. So this is the most common object that is most widely emphasized in many of the Buddhist traditions. Also then I added two more to that list when we, at the beginning of this retreat. And the second one was the mind. And this is also very much emphasized in a number of Buddhist traditions. So particularly in the Tibetan tradition, very much emphasized, particularly in the Kagyu Nyingma school, to use the mind as the object of focus for shamatha practice. Because both in the Kagyu and Nyingma school, when it comes to vipassana practice, then the focus is the mind. So if we're already using the mind in shamatha practice, then we're preparing well for the vipassana practice. So therefore, it's emphasized very much in these schools. But also, I think that the mind, for many of us, even though many of us maybe find that much more difficult than focusing on the breath, for many of us, it could be a very good, the best object to use. Because again, many of us are the slaves of our mind. We're really overwhelmed by our mind. Always following our thoughts and emotions, memories, getting caught up in our stories, being overwhelmed by them. And then, of course, if something unpleasant comes up, we don't know how to deal with it. We just try and suppress it, which creates a lot of physical problems. And then we project a lot of negativity onto others. I mean, really, we are the slaves of our mind. In this practice of focusing on the mind, this is also going to be very helpful. One of the particular benefits of this practice is we are, of course, learning to be able to be the observer or witness, to train ourselves to simply be the observer or witness of our own mind, meaning that not to get caught up in our mental events, not needing to suppress them. So instead of being the slaves of our mind, we're going to become the masters of our mind. So this is one of the immediate benefits of this practice, is to give ourselves a little bit of breathing space from all this stuff in our mind that normally torments us. And of course, then our mind will also become more still and quiet as well. So I think this is an enormous benefit that we can receive in this practice, even though often people find it quite difficult to practice. And one of the things, and of course we've been doing that a number of days in the morning before breakfast, one of the things that I've been emphasizing in that practice, of course, is to have the eyes open. In general, in meditation, the general recommendation is to have the eyes slightly open, because if we have them closed, then we often become very dull and sleepy. And if we have them too open, too much stimulation and agitation. But in this practice of observing the mind, it's very much recommended to have them open. And there are a number of reasons for that. And to highlight some of those reasons, I'd like to read from this book here, Attention Revolution, from Alan Wallace. And this is, of course, all about the shamatha practice. And he comments on this very point in the section of the text talking about focusing on the mind. And the instruction here is, let the gaze be vacant. And then he comments on this. He says, In this practice, it is important that your eyes are open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. If you have not meditated with your eyes open, you may find this uncomfortable, but I encourage you to get used to it. Blink as often as you like and don't strain your eyes in any way. Let them be as relaxed as if you were daydreaming with your eyes open. By leaving the eyes open while focusing your attention on the domain of mental events, the artificial barrier between inner and outer begins to dissolve. Especially in our materialist society, we have gotten used to the idea that our thoughts and all other mental events are inside our heads. But this has never been demonstrated scientifically. All that is known in this regard is that the mental events are correlated with neural events, but that doesn't necessarily mean they are located in the same place. Even without the materialist assumption that the mind is nothing more than a function of the brain, we naturally have a sense that we are looking out on the world from behind our eyes. But this sense of an independent subject or ego inside the head is an illusion. There is no scientific support for such a belief. And when it is inspected through rigorous contemplative inquiry, this autonomous thinker and observer inside the head is nowhere to be found. In this practice, by leaving your eyes open, but by directing your attention to the mind, this conceptually superimposed demarcation between inner and outer begins to erode. You begin to recognize that your thoughts are not occurring in here in your head, nor are they occurring out there in space. This practice challenges the existence of an absolutely objective space of the physical senses that is absolutely separate from the subjective space of the mind. You are now on a path to realizing the meaning of non-duality. So, 86. So, there's a few benefits here from the eyes open in this practice. As he mentioned, one of them is by having the eyes open, then we don't have this artificial sense of inner and outer. And if we have our eyes closed, there really is a sense there's me in here and a world out there. And from what we're going to look in the Vipassana section of the text coming up next, is this is artificial, a wrong sense. So by having the eyes open, then it doesn't reinforce that false sense of inner and outer. But also, of course, with the eyes open, and with the eyes open, of course, we're not actually deliberately focusing on anything. But equally well, we're not trying to deliberately unfocus our eyes. You know, often people in this practice somehow try to make their vision blurry. And then, of course, they start getting strain on the eyes and getting headaches. So we don't want to do that. So just vacantly resting the gaze in the space in front of you. And by having the eyes open, even though we're not really looking at anything, the visual field is a little bit engaged still. And therefore, that helps us to stay in the present moment. Because if we have the eyes closed, it's much easier to drift into the past and the future. Whereas if you have them open, then it's easier to stay in the present moment. Even though you're not really looking at anything, the visual gaze is somewhat engaged. And of course, that only happens in the present moment. So you probably find that it's easiest to stay present with the eyes open. But also, of course, there's light coming in. So with the eyes closed, again, often then we become quite dull. So you'll find that with the eyes open, then you can more easily overcome dullness. So the mind often tends to be more clear, more clarity. So these are some of the advantages of having the eyes open in this practice. First, again, is to overcome this false sense of inner and outer. Of course, this is going to be a good basis or help when we go into the Vipassana practice. And then also the present moment and clarity of having the eyes open. When I first started meditating many years ago, I was very much agitated like many people. And so I found that even having them slightly open, I got agitated. So actually I had them closed. That helped initially to overcome some agitation, but of course then you just slowly drift into dullness. But my main problem initially was agitation distraction. So a little bit of dullness, okay, but better that than huge distraction and agitation. So for a while that sort of was okay, but then eventually as that calmed down, then of course the dullness became more the problem. And when I was introduced to this approach some years ago, then as Alan Moss said, you know, when I first did this, I was completely uncomfortable, you know, like, oh, I can't do this. But actually very quickly I got used to it, and now I basically only meditate with my eyes open. With this approach, of course, when we're at home, a couple of things can be helpful. One is don't put a lot of stuff in front of you because your eyes are going to sort of, you know, and certainly don't have a little flickering candle there because you'll get drawn to it. So no movement, and better something very plain. So you can sort of do the Zen thing and just have a blank wall. And also you can adjust the lighting. Personally, I prefer quite dim, so we can adjust the lighting. So if you get quite agitated, then maybe more dim. If you're getting a bit dull, maybe a bit more light at home. And also the gaze, you can adjust the gaze. Generally, it's said to sort of look so that naturally you're looking a little bit downwards. But again, if you find that you're getting a little bit dull, you can raise the gaze. Or if you're getting a bit agitated or then you lower it, so you can play with that as well. So these are some things you can adjust at home.
So, I have a question about the passage you read. It challenged me. I just like to clarify that what's being said in there is that although the neural activity associated with your thoughts is in your head, that's not the totality of your thoughts, I think, is what he's saying.
Well, no, he said that...
There's more to it than that, so don't get hung up on.
No, he didn't say more to it. What he said was that from a Buddhist perspective... We don't equate thoughts with neural activity. You know, in the materialistic view, there is nothing more than some electrical signals and chemical flow. That is a thought. Nothing more than that. From a Buddhist perspective, they wouldn't accept that. So, what he's saying is that just because there is electrical signals, chemical flow going on in the head at the time of a thought, doesn't necessarily mean the thought is located there. They are correlates, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're located in the same physical place. That's what he's saying. This is the Buddhist assertion. But again, in the shamatha practice, we are not thinking about these sorts of things. We're simply using the eyes open to at least not reinforce this idea. So that then when we come to Vipassana practice, then we can start to entertain questions about, well, you know, where is this observer or witness that really seems to be maybe in my head even? This is Vipassana practice. This is coming later.
I had to share a little bit of my experience because I used Buddha.
As the image, yeah?
As an image. And I found that normally when I start sitting down, I'm kind of agitated, but the minute I visualize that Buddha actually enter my body, that we are one, and then I recite a mantra, Deata Om Muni Muni Mahamuniya Soha, reciting that.
Sure.
And then just like within a second, everything calmed down, and then the more I do that, the deeper I can go.
Sure.
And then I can surrender my body to Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
And then I notice that it's guiding me. He's guiding me to relax my body, to straighten my back and all that. So, I don't know, maybe just an imagination, but it works for me.
Yeah,
so
yeah. Exactly. I mean, when we right at the beginning of this section, we talked about the six preparations, then part of that six preparations was to have this merit field, which can be very extensive, or it can simply be Shakyamuni Buddha or our teacher. And then often as part of that preparation is we make requests to receive inspiration, and then we imagine that they absorb into our body, the teacher or Shakyamuni Buddha, and then the mind becomes very uplifted. So exactly as you said, if we do this preparation, and that may involve reciting a few mantras, then the mind is very uplifted, and then the mind is joyful and uplifted and focused, and we can do this practice much better. So yes, this is a very good important point. And again, if we, the key with the shamatha is use the object that works best for you. So if a mental image of a Buddha is you can remain calm, clear, inspired, then use that. If you find that the breath works best for you, use that. If the mind works best, use that. So use whatever object works best for you. That is the recommendation here. But and what we're not to do in shamatha practice is keep swapping that every day. You know, one day we use the breath, the next day the mind, and then a mental image of something, and keep swapping it around. This is not going to be productive.
Yeah, using the breath is good for the beginning, but in a certain stage, there is no breath anymore. You don't have sense of breath in and out. It's just everything is like a, you know, like nature.
Yeah. Well, with using the breath is that initially, of course, our breathing is quite coarse. And as the mind settles down, the breathing settles down and it becomes very subtle. So this is one of the big advantages with using the breath here, is that as the mind settles down, the breathing settles down, the sensations get much, much more subtle, which forces us to focus more clearly. So it increases clarity. And it gets very subtle, very, very subtle. And even if there's no so much movement of the breath, there's still sensations here. So even between, like, often there's also this little gap between when the out-breath finishes and the in-breath starts. Then we are to simply observe the sensations that are here in between those periods. So there's always sensations here to observe. But what you're going to notice in the path to shamatha, as your mind settles down and becomes more calm, clear, and focused, your sense faculties shut down. So as you go along the path of shamatha, you're not going to notice sensations anymore because your sense faculties have shut down. But fortunately, what happens before you get to that point is that if you're using the breath as an object, you get what's called the acquired sign, which is a mental image related to the air element. So spontaneously, it's not something you create, spontaneously as you're going using the breath, you will get some mental image. And that mental image can be very different depending on the person. You know, it can be a light, it can be some they even talk about cobweb, and I mean all sorts of stars and all sorts of possibilities. But it says when you get that mental image, and it's not something with the visual, it's mental, then you switch from focusing on the sensations to that mental image. And you use that the rest of the way to shamatha. So that's what's said in the meditation texts. So that's what's called the acquired sign.
You took us through a progression of items that seemed to work really well for me. I started losing some of my body. Is it legitimate to just follow that progression rather than pick a single object?
Okay. So again, the recommendation in the shamatha practice, and we need to take a break and then more questions, is stick with a single object. But it's really saying here, don't keep swapping all the time. So there's a middle way which also can be beneficial. Is that, for example, let's say we want to use the mind as the object now, but it just is impossible. We just get frustrated. We're not going anywhere. Then we can start with the breath for some time, maybe weeks, months, or years. And then once with the breath, the mind calms down, gets more stable and clear. Then later we swap to using the mind and then we continue with that. And so this is also the advice that Alan Wallace gives here in his book, is that for many beginners, probably the best place to start is the breath. But then as we've progressed quite some way, then we can swap to using a more subtle object like the mind or even this resting in awareness, which we did a little bit this morning. So this is possible and could be very helpful, but keeping swapping every day or so, the object is counterproductive. Maybe one last question then before we go for the break. You had a question?
It was sort of related to that. You know, in the very beginning, is it worthwhile? I mean, if you really don't have an idea, is it worthwhile to try the breath?
Yes. Yeah. I think that can be a wise approach, is to experiment with each one of these for a week or two or 10 days, and then see from that what sort of works, and then pick one. Yeah, that's possible. That's good. The one you resonate with. So remember, part of this is the having this joyous perseverance. So if you're not sort of enjoying it, then it's going to be difficult. Yeah. And that's why also for many people, the mind can work better. Even though it seems to be more difficult, sometimes people, when they do the breath, they get a little bit bored with it. But of course, again, the boredom often comes because they don't really realize the benefits. I mean, if we really, there's a problem that there's this initial sort of hump that we have to get over with the breath or with any object. Until we get there, then we get frustrated and bored and that. But once we get to past that point, even the breath is fascinating. And even the experiences we receive with that practice will be very joyful. But whereas with the mind, even at a beginning point, the mind is always interesting. There's always lots of stuff going on. The mind doesn't tend to be too boring. Unless, of course, we're half asleep, you know. Okay. Let's break there and come back at 10:45, and then we'll continue on with this explanation.